Hello, my name's Emily Part, and I'm an associate in the safeguarding unit at Farrow & Co. I'm here today with Genevieve Woods and Jan Pickles to talk about the Independent Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse, or ICSA. Jen's a barrister practicing in criminal and public law with a particular focus on public inquiries and safeguarding cases. Jan is an independent safeguarding expert and an experienced social worker. They've both been involved in ICSA over the past few years and have also been involved in independent safeguarding reviews commissioned by schools and sports bodies. As a quick recap, I'm going to remind us all of the background to ICSA. ICSA was established in 2015 following widespread revelations of historic child sexual abuse and exploitation. Since then, the inquiry has conducted 19 investigations, issuing over 107 recommendations. As part of that process, nearly 3 million pages of evidence have been received and processed. There have been 325 days of public and preliminary hearings, 725 witnesses, and over 100 recommendations. The final report was published last month on the 20th of October 2022, and it included 20 overarching recommendations for consideration by the government and public bodies. So here we are at the end of the long and winding road that has been ICSA, 7 years down the line. Jen and Jen, thanks so much for joining me today to talk about it. And Jen, I'm going to come to you first with a big question.
Of
What have we
course.
learned?
Well, it's been 7 years since the inquiry started, 8 long years since it was announced. I don't think anyone could have predicted it would be such a long journey, nor that it would cost quite so much. I don't think when Theresa May, Home Secretary back then, that's how long ago we're talking, when she announced it, that she could possibly have imagined it would run for almost a decade and cost more than £186 million.
Yeah.
The world looks very different now to when the inquiry was announced. Back then, there was no Me Too, no everyone's invited, and our safeguarding landscape is dramatically different. Despite that, I think even safeguarding experts were horrified by the statistics revealed in the final report. By one estimate, which was described as being conservative, there are 500,000 children abused in a single year in England and Wales. 15% of all girls are sexually abused before the age of 16. That's of all girls in England and Wales. And 20 children are referred to SARC centres every day. So while the release of the report was rather overshadowed by the resignation of a certain prime minister, those statistics are something we should all be talking about.
Absolutely. It's horrifying, isn't it? And the accounts of the victims from the Truth Project are very moving. And the bravery of the people that have been involved, I think, is something that must be commended, although obviously we'd all rather they didn't have to do that in the first place.
It must have taken enormous courage. And I think the Truth Project was one of the most valuable things to come out of this inquiry, doing much needed listening and much needed sharing of the accounts of survivors of abuse.
Absolutely. Jan, looking at the recommendations from the final report, which are the ones that sort of stick out to you as particularly interesting for whatever reason, if there's a couple that you wanted to pick up on?
Well, I agree with Jen that we've had seismic change during the lifetime of ICSA. Me too, and everyone's invited. But the clear message that came out for me from ICSA was that cover up is no longer an option. I think now we are asking better questions. This was a backward look. So we're asking questions about prevalence. The numbers that Jen gave are horrific. But what I'm hearing from organisations is a cultural shift so that it can happen here, it can happen in our school, in our parish, in our sport. And we're asking questions about prevention and how we offer meaningful support to victims and how we manage those that cause harm so they don't do it again. So we've got 20 recommendations. So how do you choose? Yes, it's important to have a good understanding of the data, but that doesn't, in a way, give us that all that shift, that cultural change. It shocks people, but does it actually bring about changes in behaviour? For me, the language is important because I can see that they've gone back to the language of child protection, and I'm long enough in my career to have been through these kind of language changes. But that shift from safeguarding to child protection, that greater focus on that small number of young people that need protecting, I'd like to say the Scots have never left that language. If you mention safeguarding in Scotland, they know immediately you're from England because they still use the language of child protection. So for me, there's three key ones, and that's the mandatory reporting, leadership, and the support and redress. And mandatory reporting, making it clear to all of us that it's your duty to act and not turn a blind eye. So much of this happened in plain sight. It should all make us, whatever our role, so whether you be a grounds person or a deacon or a sides person or an assistant coach, that you've got a duty to listen and to act. If you don't, the abuser will go on to harm others and you could have prevented it. And over the course of my work, I've seen many people who said, if only I'd done something at the moment. I don't know why I didn't now when I look back on it. I think leadership is really key, and a Minister for Children seems a no-brainer to me. I live in Wales and we have a Future Generations Act and a commissioner that means that all public spending and activity has to be looked at through the lens of the impact on future generations. We need somebody at that top table asking these questions. For me, the third key one is support and redress. So how do we do that? I've worked alongside many victims whose lives have been blighted. They feel their childhood was stolen, their relationships in the future have been going forward for them were blighted. And that any time something in life, when it goes wrong, it comes down to them not deserving that love, that happiness. They don't deserve any small measure of success because they're not worthy. So my advice for any institution hearing of abuse, whether it be current or whether it be from the past, is to lean in, to listen, to acknowledge and respond. It's not about insurance, it's about integrity. Create a care pathway, really, so that everybody knows we're doing the right thing and we'll get the best outcomes.
Thanks, Jan. And one of the points that ICSA considered in the report is sort of the public perceptions of child abuse and whether it's sort of in the public eye and thought about sufficiently. And obviously ICSA has done a lot of work to bring child sex abuse to the forefront of public minds. Do you think that creating child protection authorities for England and Wales, which is the second recommendation, as well as the Minister for Children, which is the third recommendation, do you think that could have positive impact on social perceptions of the existence of child abuse?
Well, I'm sure it will. It's about focus. At the moment, children are lost. If you look across government departments, children get lost. That ongoing difficulty between the Home Office and the DfE, where does radicalisation sit? Where does domestic abuse sit? Well, actually, we need someone to have that overarching focus on the quality of our children's lives, the right that they have a childhood free from degrading treatment and in some cases torture.
Yeah, and I think, you know, looking at sort of the barriers to disclosure and structural issues, some of the cited reasons why participants in the Truth Project didn't disclose child sexual abuse at the time it occurred included because they felt they didn't have anyone to disclose to, or they didn't have the words to explain. And I think that's part of the education that that ICSA and safeguarding experts are trying to do across the piece, and perhaps having child protection authorities can assist with that continued education. Jan touched briefly then on the mandatory reporting recommendations. We've worked together on faith-based organisations as part of ICSA. For those listening who haven't looked at the recommendations in detail, recommendation 13 covers the potentially controversial issue in some circles of mandatory reporting, recommending the introduction of legislation which places mandatory reporters under a statutory duty to report child sexual abuse, where they receive a disclosure from a child or perpetrator, witness the abuse, or observe indicators of such abuse. Mandatory reporters, ICSA recommends, should include any person working in regulated activity related to children or in a position of trust and police officers. What do you make of the recommendations around mandatory reporting and, for example, how they compare to mandatory reporting requirements in Australia?
Well, I think the first thing to say is I'm not surprised the inquiry made this recommendation. I think as we went through the hearings, it became clear that the weight of the evidence before the inquiry was in favour. And surprisingly, 88% of survivors who engaged with the inquiry were in favour, which is interesting because the main objection is often that survivors are against it because it could potentially discourage disclosure. But I am coming from an Australian background, where mandatory reporting has been in place across a range of different states since the 1960s. So it's not a new idea. I've seen it in action. In fact, I've been a mandatory reporter myself. I think there's a lot of fear attached to the idea of mandatory reporting. But the truth is that what it requires is what Jan said. It's essentially the same obligations that are already in place on people who hold safeguarding roles. The real difference is that this puts the weight of the law behind it. And in my experience, that can actually be helpful. It takes the burden of responsibility for the decision off the shoulders of safeguarders. There's no debate about what to do. There is a clear path and far less scope for blaming a teacher or a coach or a doctor for making a decision to report when they're legally required to do so. Having said that, you described mandatory reporting in this report as being controversial. And I think that's right. And I think there are three real issues that are controversial. The first is that, surprisingly, the recommendation made by ICSA would not require mandatory reporters to act on disclosures from anyone except the victim or the perpetrator, unless they see it happen themselves. So say, for example, a child says to their doctor, "My uncle has been abusing my sister or my brother at home and I saw it happen." That's not something that has to be reported. Or say a child says to their teacher in school, "My best friend told me that the sports coach hurt them." That doesn't have to be reported because it's coming from a third party. That's an obvious omission in the recommendation. The second thing is that the inquiry has allowed an exemption, a very controversial exemption, where the child is aged between 13 and 16 and is deemed to be in a consensual relationship with the other party, and where there's no material difference in their capacity or maturity. It's just an impossible exemption. It's designed to prevent criminalizing teenagers who are in relationships together. But the idea that a mandatory reporter could sensibly assess whether a relationship is potentially coercive or whether the child might be at risk of harm or what the relative levels of maturity and capacity of the parties are is just unrealistic. What would a material difference in capacity be that requires you to make a report, as opposed to a non-material difference in capacity between the parties? It's just very unhelpful.
And particularly in the context of, you know, they're only required to make these reports where there's a disclosure made or they witness something. If they've witnessed what they think is child sexual abuse, and presumably it's not going to be in a consensual relationship, and if the perpetrator or the child's disclosed it to them, then equally it would seem that it can't also be consensual. It doesn't seem to flow from the recommendations that they're giving in the first place. But I agree it definitely seems to be aimed at those teenage relationships. But I suppose you wouldn't expect those to fall into the child sexual abuse category to begin with.
I think that's right. And it highlights a problem, I think, throughout the inquiry, which is that it wasn't keeping pace with the seismic changes in society that were happening at the same time, and particularly in relation to peer-on-peer abuse, which is now an issue at the heart of safeguarding. But when the inquiry started, it was barely on anyone's radar. It ought to have been. It's great that it is now. But I think this recommendation has been designed without taking into account the complexity of that culture of peer-on-peer abuse being at the heart of safeguarding now. It is a big change, and the recommendation doesn't take into account the complexity of that. The third issue with mandatory reporting, if you can stand another one, is that in Australia, there are rules protecting the identity of mandatory reporters. So their identities don't get disclosed if they make a mandatory report. And there are rules protecting them from proceedings or being sued, essentially, if a report is made in good faith. And ICSA isn't recommending any of that, which may be a cause for concern. And in Australia, there are in some states exemptions for clergy under the seal of the confession. And that's not something ICSA has included in their recommendation. But the bottom line is, we don't actually know whether the government's going to implement this, or if they do, whether they'll implement it in the form that ICSA has recommended. So we have to watch this space, wait and see what happens.
Thanks, Jen. Dan, we've been talking so far about the recommendations that are in the report. From your experience conducting safeguarding reviews for organisations, do you think there's anything particular missing from the recommendations or not sufficiently emphasised?
Well, it's Jen's point about, you know, this investigation, their investigations have been backward looking. And although they've heard from 7,000, the majority of adults that have approached the Truth Project. So for me, the question is, and it's what Me Too and everyone's invited has raised, that the difference in the world that we have now than when the inquiry started is, what of children and young people today? I mean, I think schools understand child on child abuse so much better now, following everyone's invited, and victims are encouraged to speak up. But it's important that we, the adults, tool up on spotting inappropriate sexualized behavior, whether that be from a member of staff or within peer child on child relationships. And I find the Hackett tool particularly helpful, where we're looking at what's inappropriate, what's problematic, and what's worse. And I find it especially helpful when engaging with young men and boys and young men, I think, and their parents. It's something people can engage with. But, you know, we need to be looking around. So it's not just about getting young people to speak up and having a voice. If no one's listening, well, what difference does that make? And so for me, there's more needs to be done about tooling us up so that we can hear it without just immediately reacting. You know, we see that banter is not acceptable now, but we don't really have an agreed counter narrative to the incel ideas which are bandied around on the internet and spill into our schools.
And is that something you're seeing more and more of, these incel ideas, Jen?
Definitely. We're hearing, particularly in independent schools, we're hearing young people, young men, who are under their spell, without a doubt, the language. And unless a member of staff can identify it and it gets flagged up, we have to have a counter narrative. We have to have that's agreed between us and an understanding of it. But I think creating a safe space for young people to share their concerns and to kind of co-produce with us what the solutions are, which in my experience are very challenging to the traditions and the way we've done things. Mm. So business as usual is being challenged by young people when they get a voice, and it's about us opening up to that. But just the acceptance by staff, whatever your role, that it can happen here, and vigilance and confidence to spot it and report it, they're really key.
Absolutely. Jen, just to touch on one of the other key recommendations that Jan mentioned earlier, Jan was talking about the redress, and recommendation 19 is the recommendation of the introduction of a single redress scheme in England and Wales. Did you have any thoughts to add on that, or anything that you thought would be helpful to discuss?
It's an interesting recommendation, and one that I'm sure has caused some disquiet among certain organisations reading the report, because the inquiry not only proposed the creation of a single redress scheme for survivors of abuse in England and Wales, but it has suggested asking for financial contributions from non-state organisations. That means churches, that means private schools, that means sporting organisations. Now, the first thing to say about that is there's no suggestion those contributions would be mandatory, like a tax. It would only ever be voluntary. And that's not something which would be implemented quickly, if it is ever implemented. Potential contributors would have plenty of time to consider whether they wish to contribute, whether it would be a positive thing to do, particularly in organisations which have a long history of abuse, or whether it would actually help or be effective. And whether that's the case will depend on what that organisation actually looks like. And we simply don't know at present. I think the suggestion is that it would be time limited, so only lasting 5 years. That seems difficult given the potential scale of applications and the ongoing nature of child abuse. As Jan said, that is a recommendation that's focused on adults, historic victims of child sexual abuse. And while they have to be at the heart of this, and they have long been neglected and not provided with the support they need, we also need to bring the focus onto current children and young people. And the support should be ongoing and sustainable over time, not limited to a particular class of survivors. But I think actually the ultimate position is we just don't know enough yet to really judge the impact it could have, either on the contributors or on those it is designed to support.
And thinking about sort of the future looking aspects of this and the lessons to be learned going forwards, Jen, what can organisations learn about their approach to allegations and victims in light of the findings and ICSER and other historical reviews?
I think there's quite a few lessons to be learned. And I think the key one is what Jan has been speaking about, bringing victims of abuse, and particularly young people, into the heart of child protection and helping them to engage and shape our responses. We have so much to learn from them, and the Truth Project epitomised that for all of us. On a more practical level, inevitably there's going to be changes in the next Keeping Children Safe in Education to reflect the inquiry recommendations, so we all have to watch out for that. I think everyone should be continuing to do their low-level concerns reporting. The inquiry was really positive about low-level concerns in one of the interim reports, the residential schools report. And I think the inquiry might have somewhat missed a trick by not including that in their final report.
Absolutely, yeah.
Farah, I know, has excellent guidance on low-level concerns. And I think it's on the Safeguarding Hub, if any listeners want to check that out. Shameless plug, I'm afraid.
Thanks,
but Jen. It is helpful guidance. The other thing I think would be record keeping, because ICSA made a recommendation about retaining records, which is different to the GDPR and the requirements of what the current state of the law is. ICSA has recommended keeping records for a period of, I think, 75 years to bring it in line with the guidance for records held about children in care homes. Now, to some extent, that's sensible because we know it's been a problem in historic cases. Emily, you and I had to grapple with some records from the 1950s and earlier, which were totally illegible, incomplete, and the inquiry certainly did not take kindly to the state of the records. And of course, there is a real risk. If the records aren't there to support you, to show what you've done, then there may be a presumption against you in safeguarding proceedings in future. Remember that every record you make now could save yourself in a decade, or more importantly, could strengthen the case when concerns are raised in order to protect children down the line. For the moment, 75 years is only a recommendation, and unless and until that changes, everyone should be following the law and the guidance as it stands. But again, we have to watch this space to see if that is a recommendation which is implemented.
Thanks, Jen. Dan, what about, you've done a lot of work on historical reviews for different clients and different sectors. From those experiences, what do you think organisations should be doing now to better protect potential victims and to protect themselves, in addition to these points that Jen's been making about record keeping?
Well, I think the potential for historical and non-recent allegations should always be considered by the leadership in your organisation. Almost having a dry run, using one of the cases that's been reviewed and stress test your organisation's ability to respond against the findings from that review. An organisation said to me yesterday, reflecting on a big review that's been completed, it's never happened here before, we were shooting in the dark. So think the unthinkable and be prepared. We've worked with organisations where the members of the governing body have sought training on trauma so they don't end up tripping themselves up when they're negotiating with angry, distressed victims who maybe have damage going back decades. I often find when I'm called in that a safeguarding lead in a church or sport or a DSL or head when dealing with a complaint or a disclosure of historic child sex abuse looks to their archives and, as you and Jen have said, finds little recorded. We know why that is. A member of staff left under a cloud, or in the worst cases was actively moved on in the interests. It was seen as being in the interests of the children or framed in that way. But you then find a bursar or a secretary who's been there 20 years and remembers something happened, but it's lost in the midst of time, really. So my advice would be to proactively look for potential historic issues, check in your archive, talking to people who've worked in your organisation for many years, that historic memory before they retire and go. Hopefully today we'll have robust recording, and the recommendations on storage I think is very challenging. But you know, in the 80s things were different. In the early 80s I ran a sex offender group in probation. We never saw offenders, people who defended against children. They weren't convicted because it wasn't taken seriously. So I suppose for me it's, to work with victims, you have to lean in and you have to be transparent. It's important to have a human response in all of this. Whilst you're in the background trying to find your timeline, struggling to put these pieces of a jigsaw that are badly recorded together. Because only by being transparent will victims feel that they're being taken seriously and heard.
Absolutely. And to have that focus on the victim, as you say, is just, I think, paramount in cases of child sexual abuse. And Jen, for organisations, do you think that there's a real value in sort of conducting safeguarding reviews and audits? And how have you found from your experience helping with those processes that organisations have benefited?
Well, I think this is a good opportunity for me to sound a note of caution for everyone listening, which is to say, don't think that just because ICSA has concluded that the risk to yourself or your organisation is gone. Safeguarding reviews and audits are increasingly common. As you say, Emily, I've done quite a few even over the past year. They're especially common in sport. I know that within schools, regulators in particular are paying greater attention to safeguarding every day. Scrutiny now is greater than it has ever been. Jan said, it's not about insurance, it's about integrity. And that's a phrase we all have to remember when we're undergoing an audit or an inspection or a review. The stakes are the highest possible. I can't overstate it. The decisions that you are making on the ground every day can save a child's life. And if you get it right, you may never know that that's happened. You might not see what you've prevented, but that should never be a reason to be complacent. We have to get this right. If you are not sure how to do that, if you've got an impending review or an audit, or even if you are dealing with an individual case or a concern and you're not sure what to do, the answer is always to seek advice. And that might mean talking to the ladder, might mean talking to your regulator, it might mean calling a mentor or a safeguarding advisor. But child protection only works with everyone's collaboration and cooperation. And the fact that ICSA has now come to an end does not change that. If anything, it reinforces it.
Thanks, Jen. I think that's a really important and powerful message. We've already really touched the sides of what is a over 450-page report, but I think hopefully touched on the key points that are going to be relevant to people listening. Thank you so much, Jen and Jan, for joining me today to talk about it. I really appreciate it. We've learned a great deal. There's still a lot of work to be done. And I look forward to working with you both more to make sure that we are helping to provide a strong and protective place for children.